You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
March can be won, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done, singly done. And by union, what we will can be accomplished still. Drops of water turn a mill, singly done, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved.
And welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by the International Association of Firefighters, Local 42, and Pipe Fitters, Local 533. Greater Kansas City Firefighters, Local 42 of the International Association of Firefighters, represents 12 bargaining units within the metropolitan area made up of firefighters, paramedics, EMTs, and prosecuting attorneys. Pipe Fitters, Local 533, being the best in the industry, is earned. Our craftsmanship, brotherhood, training, and job safety make the difference. Building and buying union create better wages and living standards for all working families. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, sheltered workshops and 22 cents an hour, the fight to ban the sub-minimum wage. Should the slogan, "Good Jobs for All," include the disabled? In Missouri, it's not so clear. This week on the Heartland Labor Forum, we'll hear from Representative Bridget Walsh Moore on the availability and prognosis for jobs for differently abled citizens. Then, Doug Crandall, author of 22 Cents an Hour, Disability Rights and the Fight to End Subminimum Wages, uncovers the harsh reality of people with disabilities in the United States who are forced to work in unethical conditions for subminimum wages with little or no opportunity to advocate for themselves. We'll ask him if there is a U.S. disability industrial complex, how such unjust policies came about, and who benefits. In the news, did the company where 16-year-old Will Hampton was crushed to death last week violate child labor laws? Coalition demonstrates for community benefits agreements if the Royals build a new stadium. Our feature is Know Your Rights with Michael Amash, and Pledge Drive continues. Thanks to all of our donors for keeping community radio alive and well. And now, the news. This is the news from our side, June 15th, 2023. Remember the Wabak strike in Kansas City earlier this year. The union IBEW 1464 fought the company, formerly GE's locomotive department, for the promised restoration of concessions made several years ago. Wabtec didn't only tussle with its Kansas City workers, but PAI reports its 1,400 workers in Erie, Pennsylvania have been on strike. They're members of United Workers Union Local 506. And what's important for workers, both union and non-union, nationally because of recent Supreme Court decision to holding a union responsible, some to the cost to an employer of a strike. This despite the legal guarantee of the right to strike. To be precise, the law's key Section 7 declares workers have the right to self-organization, to form, join, or assist labor organizations, to bargain collectively through representatives of their own choosing, and to engage in other concerted activities for the purpose of collective bargaining or other mutual aid or protection. This protects workers who strike, even if they don't have a union. Local 506 at Wabtec, like most unions, have a contract that gives the workers the right to strike over wages, benefits, and working conditions once a contract has reached its end. Additionally, the contract permits the locals to strike over transfer of work out to the plant, company subcontracting of union jobs, and deliberate company delays in handling grievances. A study of the right to strike over grievances done by the University of Illinois found that the threat of a strike leads to speedier and more equitable settlements of disputes. Wabtec's lead shop steward said, "Wabtec asked us to put a little trust in them, and they've repeatedly abused it by slowing down grievances, which in turn have mounted, even when the firm's excuses for disciplining workers have been demonstrably false. Some grievances have been pending for years," UE President Carl Rosen said. "Wabtec has felt free to violate the contract's terms," Rosen said. "Morale has plunged, and workers are cynical and angry."
Confined Space Newsletter reports on the death of last week of Will Hampton. The 16-year-old crushed in a recycling site last week in Lee Summit. He had barely started a summer job at the Lee Summit Resource and Recovery Park. It was around 10 a.m. when he was pinned between a tractor-trailer rig and its trailer. The plant is owned by the city of Lee Summit, Missouri, and operated by Casey Dumpster Company, LLC. OSHA is investigating, as is the Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division, to see if child labor laws were violated. Wage and Hour lists the jobs that workers under age 18 are not allowed to do. The Missouri Department of Labor has its own list for kids under 16, but as yet, there's no information on the job Hampton was doing. Will's tragic death reminds us there's a national crisis developing in child labor as states under pressure from corporate groups weaken their child labor laws. That's the topic of next week's show on the Heartland Labor Forum.
Hundreds of poor and working people, faith and labor leaders, elected officials, and other community members held a rally and press conference at noon yesterday outside of Kansas City City Hall to demand living wage, quality service, and hospitality jobs and affordable housing if the Kansas City Royals proceed with building their proposed $2 billion downtown stadium district, what would be the largest private public development project in the history of the city. Elected officials, including Clay County Western Commissioner John Carpenter, Jackson County's 1st District Legislator Manny Abarca, and Kansas City's 4th District Councilman Eric Bunch, spoke at the event. John Carpenter said, quote, "If the Royals want billions of dollars of tax money at a minimum, what they can do is pay people who work to make that possible a living wage. They certainly pay themselves a living wage to do that work, and then some," end quote. Manny Abarca told the crowd, quote, "The impact of this $2 billion stadium could be catastrophic or catalytic. Which one do we want it to be? I will stand with you now, tomorrow, in the rain. I will be with you to make sure we get what we demand," end quote. Terrence Wise from Stand Up Kansas City said, quote, "The Royals say they're listening, but it feels like they didn't hear us. You know who else says they're listening to me? McDonald's, Burger King, Arby's. Some even call us family. But they're not sitting down and negotiating a better job with me. I'm tired of not having a voice in my own job, and I'm tired of not having a voice when it comes to decisions impacting my own community," end quote. The Good Jobs and Affordable Housing for All Coalition is urging a strong community benefits agreement that advances policies that enhance racial and economic justice. The news from our side was read tonight by Stephen Hill, Tom Gebkin, and I'm Mark Galis.
All right, very good. Thank you, guys. We're nearing the end of Pledge Week for KKFI, and we want to thank all the donors who have continued to provide us that lifeblood money. We need to keep this station going. Before we get to Chris Mann's interview, I want to say here we have a $100 champion in our show's producer, Judy Ansel. Thank you, Judy. Keep those lights on, and I've got Mark Galis here. He's got some words.
Well, thanks, Stephen. One of the things I appreciate most about KKFI is the diversity of musical programming. On any given day, you can listen to KKFI and hear the blues, classical, that's jazz, right, Latino music, classic country, and like I said, oftentimes in one single day, you'll hear all those different programs.
Absolutely.
So if you're interested in supporting those efforts, that rich diversity of programming, Give us a call at 888-931-0901, or you can donate online at kkfi.org.
Very good. And again, that number is 888-931-0901, or go to kkfi.org and donate at any time.
Like the sea meets every shore, not an if but it's a when. From beginning to the end, I am fire in the rain. I've been through it all before, and I'd go through it again. Feel me burning from within, 'cause I am fire in.
For a good band, check us out.
Check us out.
When you're looking for a good beat, count us in. When you're looking for a good sound, you'll hear us shout. When you're looking for a good time, you'll fit right in. If you're wondering what we're all about, we're the only good band in the world. If you can't understand all the words, all we need to do is turn it up loud. Yeah, turn it up louder.
I can see you without staring at you. I can feel you, we don't have to touch. I'm a differently abled man, and I matter so much. And I matter so much.
Welcome, KKFI listeners, to the Heartland Labor Forum, and welcome to another segment. During this segment, we'll be discussing disability employment rights in Missouri. Does Good Jobs for All really include people who are differently abled? And aren't all of us differently abled? What does it mean when a society when we undervalue workers who are disabled? Before I introduce our guests, the musical medley you've just listened to were songs which involve musicians who are disabled or have entirely been composed by people with disabilities. The first song was a music video called I Am Fire in the Rain. Look beyond my disability, see the true me. Fire in the Rain music video was produced by director Royston Tan. The original song composition was Don Richman, and rap lyrics were Shiga Shea. The second song is composed and sung by three musicians who met at Gallaudet University in Washington. They are musicians who are deaf and compose and play their own music. Their band name is Beethoven's Nightmare. They have their fame continues to grow as they travel across the United States and they've been in Europe. The last song is I'm a Differently Abled Man was sung by Caitlin Nicole. The music video is dedicated to all differently abled people in the world. The video song was written by Lisa Brozak, Kelsey Roche, David Granati, and Hermie Granati, and produced at the Maplewood Studio in Ambridge, Pennsylvania, which is right outside Pittsburgh. Our guest tonight needed no second invitation to come to this discussion. Bridget Walshmore is a representative to the Missouri State Representatives in the House. In response to the question, what issues are you most passionate about? Bridget writes, As a cancer survivor, health care is my top priority, whether it is access to affordable health care, building resources in rural communities, or defending abortion access. I'm giving all to the fight. Following the birth of my son, I filed HB 2822 for parental and medical leave so all families are able to take care of their loved ones. My passion for disability rights and employment permeate all of my actions as a legislator. Persons with disabilities deserve the opportunity for integrated, competitive employment for fair wages. We will, and I'll leave her to explain other stuff. And Haley Bishop is a spokesperson for the whole person here in Kansas City. The vision from the whole person, as listed, is the whole person envisions a fully accessible community where opportunities and choices are not limited by disability. They hope to do this by connecting people with disabilities to the resources they need by supporting independent choice and advocating for positive change in the community. So welcome, Bridget and Haley. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having us. Yeah. So excited to be here.
Yeah. Both of you, what interested you most in disability rights for both of you to make it the center of your focus? Haley, you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. For me personally, I grew up around a lot of individuals with various abilities and disabilities. So I've been really interested and kind of ingrained in that sector for a really long time. I started my career out as a special education teacher, so I kind of had a lot of firsthand experience working with all kinds of different individuals from all ages, and it's just something I'm really passionate about. I think a lot of people overlook that population a lot, so I have a liking to them, and I think I like to be the person who helps them be seen and be heard by others.
And Bridget?
My background is basically what first drew me in is as a child, I attended a small parochial school where we had a student a few years younger than me who utilized a wheelchair, and our 1960s school building was not great at accommodating her. But it was wonderful to see the school community come together and just bend over backwards, and everyone pitched in to make sure that she got everything that every other student did. She was not treated any differently, and any activity she wanted to do, we made it work. So that was really my first exposure, but it took on a whole new meaning when in 2014, I developed cancer in my right hip, and which led to a full hemipelvectomy. So I lost my right leg. That took on a whole new meaning. My life was turned upside down. It literally became a whole new world with me utilizing a wheelchair and forearm crutches and becoming a person with disabilities myself. I was privileged enough to have supports, have an education, have an incredible family and a work community that immediately adapted to me, just immediately embraced me. But I saw very quickly how that was not the case for everyone, and I wanted to really reach out to everyone else who finds themselves in these positions, because I was no less capable than I was the day before my surgery, before my amputation. I just needed a little help getting there.
Yeah, and what, both of you, can you tell us what sheltered workshops are, and tell us some why they're valuable, and what are the drawbacks?
I think sheltered workshops are kind of best described as really just a very highly supervised, separate environment that really strictly focuses on hiring individuals with disabilities as their employees, typically doing some small assembly related tasks, most commonly for other businesses. I know there's a big debate about sheltered workshops, and I think there's definitely pros and cons to them. I would say the biggest pro is it really does give employment experience to some individuals who might not otherwise be successful in a competitive environment. who maybe have some higher support needs where they need more support. But on the flip side, I definitely can see the argument for why they might not be the best fit for everybody. A lot of individuals, kind of like Brigitte has said, are capable of doing more and can do a lot more. So a sheltered workshop might not be the best environment for all individuals. And with that, because they are such a separate environment, it kind of reinforces the idea of it's okay to keep these individuals with disabilities segregated from everybody else. So it kind of feeds into that idea sometimes, I think. And while it is really supportive for those individuals, sometimes it's really hard for them to leave to go seek competitive employment in the community, which could be good. But again, a lot of people are capable of a lot more, and we want to encourage as much independence and community integration as possible.
Would you agree with that, Bridget?
I'd have to say ditto. I mean, she nailed it. I think those are many of the things that I hear when I work with people with sheltered workshops and kind of the debate. It's difficult because there isn't really a consensus on sheltered workshops, even within the disabled community itself. So you have competing advocates within the community. And I would say some of the strongest advocates for sheltered workshops are family members and guardians. And I empathize with them. It sounds great. And it is for some people. I think it is an option. But there are some people who end up there for too long. It's just, it can be difficult for guardians to really see the potential, I think. And if you're at the time you're dealing with shelter workshops, the person with a disability is an adult. And so if you think of it from the guardians, from the family's perspective, they have fought for this child every single day of their life. They've fought the schools. They fought insurance companies. They fought the government for their benefits. They've fought everyone. Every day is a fight if you are the parent of a disabled child to make sure that they get everything they need and deserve. And so sheltered workshops, it's a sigh of relief. It is. It's a welcome place. It's comforting. It is everything you need in one spot. They do serve a purpose. Sheltered workshops are there for some individuals. I think where the problem comes in is that some people, for lack of a better word, get stuck there and just kind of feel like they could be doing more. Even if they don't even realize it, they are capable of doing more. And to Haley's point, it's usually an entirely separate facility where they aren't integrated at all. So there is this othering. And so it is kind of reinforcing old stereotypes of almost a separate but equal situation where, you know, it's okay for those people to work there and to be in that environment. And it creates, it's not really an inclusive society. It doesn't create competitive employment. And some of the point of sheltered workshops is to give basic training and kind of be a starting point, like an entry level position, if you will, and then to move on. But as we've been finding out, most sheltered workshops only have about an 80% graduation rate with people going on to competitive employment. And that's a major problem within itself. That's not a great success rate. And that's, I think we're losing a lot of people in the process who really could be make great contributions to other parts of the workforce.
Mm-hmm. And would you say that even the public transportation, if that's not strong and available in cities, it's very hard to make that up? You know, so that's why advocating for strong public transportation and strong, safe infrastructure helps everybody. It's not just handicapped people. So what do you think about the statement that citizens who are disabled and cannot keep up should be paid less?
I mean,
I feel like
it kind of came across on my face, right?
Yeah.
I I just think whoever says that is probably not the most fabulous human being ever. But besides that, I think kind of like we were talking before we kind of got on air, but there's a lot of myths around what people with disabilities can and cannot do in the workplace. And I know Bridget mentioned that too. But I think it kind of goes back to those ideas of maybe they do work differently. Maybe they work at a slower pace. Maybe they do have some accommodations, but that doesn't mean that they should get paid any less than the person who does it. I put air quotes of like the right way, because there's no right way. As long as they're doing the job that needs to get done, they should get paid for the job that they're doing.
And this goes back, like I said, to where there is not a consensus within the disabled community. So this is a hard one because there are strong advocates on both sides, and they all have good points. Some people say, oh, well, you know, in shelter workshops, it's not about the money. It's more about a sense of purpose. It's a sense of pride. It's, you know, the socialization, and all those things are well and good if you can still pay your bills. You know, I feel like the families that say, it's usually families that I'm discussing it with, not the individual, not the worker. You know, I'm like, well, that's great if you can compensate them in other ways, if they're getting what they need from government benefits, from family support, that's wonderful. But, you know, that's not enough for some people. And, you know, they still need to make a livable wage. And I think a lot of it goes back to, I mean, if we look at it from a philosophical standpoint, the minimum wage is a legal mandate. It's a legal protection. So if you look at it, are we all equal under the law or are we not? Putting in a yes, but does not work well under the law. It just allows for further discrimination and creates a second class citizenry. So it's, you know, you could argue it's completely un-American concept. However, that's, you know, that's a philosophical argument. The hard and real facts are, luckily in Missouri, we did just pass SB, the Senate Bill 106. I'm very proud to have supported that legislation, and Representative Melly Stinnett passed it in the House. She was gracious enough to carry it for me. I've tried in years past and failed because I sit on the wrong side of the aisle. And Melanie Stinnett passed it in the House, and Senator Lauren Arthur got it done in the Senate. And so that will go to the governor's desk on August 28th. So we're very excited. That addresses two things. One, Ticket to Work is addressing a lot of the fiscal cliffs within one of the caveats for the sub-minimum wage. What people say in favor of it is, well, if I earn too much money, I'll lose my Social Security benefits. And I can't live without those. I don't make enough to compensate for that. And that's persons in sheltered workshops and in competitive integrated employment. What this new legislation does is it raises the minimum of what you are allowed to make. It lets you save more so that you can take a better job, you can work more hours, you can take that promotion, you can go back to school. And that's going to have really real implications for a lot of people with disabilities. And we are getting that much closer to marriage equality. One of the things, again, with people not making enough money is they don't want to get married, because if you count as your household income, for me personally, my husband makes over $60,000. So if anything were to happen to permanently disable me, we would get nothing from the state. We would have no help whatsoever for our family. Yeah. And so the new legislation now, it eliminates the first $50,000 of the spouse. So that makes it much more doable for families. And I'm hoping we see a few more marriages out of it.
Okay. Unfortunately, this topic is very huge and very worthwhile. And I'd like to thank our guests for coming. Haley Bishop from the Whole Person and Missouri House Representative from the 93rd District in St. Louis, Bridget Walsh Moore. And thank you for your clarity and your advocacy for Missourians who are differently abled. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. KKFI 90.1 FM is a 100,000-watt beacon of free expression, mutual respect, and collaboration. Since 1988, we have stood by our philosophy of fostering a climate where diverse voices can be heard. Our commitment to diversity in programming and discourse is unwavering. We recognize that within our community, there will be differing opinions, and we celebrate that. At KKFI, we encourage a completely free and open discussion of ideas. We're committed to uplifting the voices underrepresented by mainstream media. Support our dedication to inclusivity and free speech by making a donation at kkfi.org. Together, let's continue to uplift the voices that challenge, inspire, and shape our community.
And we're back. It is pledge drive time here at KKFI.
And we spoke earlier about the diversity of program with music, but it's important to point out that we have a number of wonderful public affairs programs here at KKFI. There are shows about local public affairs, Radioactive Magazine, Cowtown Conversations, All Souls Forum, environmental issues, Eco Radio, feminist issues, Every Woman, and African-American issues, Changing Narratives. I would be remiss if I didn't also mention this program, the Heartland Labor Forum, the only show in Kansas City that deals with workplace issues from a worker's perspective. So if you are interested in supporting these programs, please give us a call at 888-931-0901 to make a donation, or online, kkfi.org.
Thanks, Mark. Chris, was there a website you wanted to tell everybody about?
Yes, I wanted to say that we just had Representative Bridget Walsh Moore on the website, on the program, and she centers herself on disability rights, and she's available to be contacted with. And then also we had Haley Bishop from The Whole Person, and what Mark was saying about having the variety in KKFI, the Heartland Labor Forum centers itself on the workplace and how important that is for people's meaning in life, and also it's how important it is to have guidelines and safety. So donate,
and keep this place special for the community.
Keep the lights on, as you say.
That's right.
And Stephen,
That number is 888-931-0901 or anytime at kkfi.org.
Clean the leaves out your drain. I'm in your roof to keep out the rain. I'll take the work that God provides. I'm a jack of all trades. Honey, we'll be all right. I'll hammer the nails and I'll set the stone. I'll harvest your crops when they're ripe and grown. I'll pull that engine apart and patch her up till she's running right. I'm a jack of all trades. We'll be all right.
Good evening. You are listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. On tonight's show, we will be talking to Doug, who just published a new book, 22 Cents an Hour, Disability Rights and the Fight to End the Minimum Wage. Welcome, Doc.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So the book is about disability rights in the U.S. Could you give us some background how this topic brought to your attention?
Yeah, I come from a family with folks with disabilities. I have a sister, particularly with disabilities, who has always worked. I come from a labor family, a union family. My father worked in a ceiling tile factory, and that's how I got through college, the first person in my family to go to college. And so we did not want our sister to work for subminimum wages because we knew she was worth more than that. I have worked in the field of employment and disability in the United States for decades. And I suppose the reason I decided to write the book was because I was a young guy when I started in this field, and people were trying to get rid of subminimum wages more than 30 years ago. And they are still legal in 2/3 of the United States. There are only about 13 states that have banned the use of subminimum wages. So I was really curious to answer your question about why that was the case. You know, every book has to have a mystery at its core for us to keep reading, whether that's nonfiction or fiction. And the mystery here to me was, how can it still possibly be legal to pay people as low as 22 cents an hour? The 22 cents comes from the National Federation for the Blind organized boycotts of Goodwill stores across the country. Because under a Freedom of Information request, we found that some Goodwill workers were making as low as 22 cents an hour. So that was kind of the reason I wanted to write the book. I wanted to find out myself who was stopping this from being banned, who didn't want it to happen.
And this was not uncommon, right? In your book, you documented cases like the Iowa turkey farm, as well as other terrible cases. The state of Missouri also has some cases. So how did such unjust policies come about in the U.S.?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's at the heart of the book. And you mentioned Henry's Turkey Service in Iowa. The book has many examples of the abuses of this labor law. So just a little history. 1938 is when the Fair Labor Standards Act was passed. Most of us learn about that in some type of history class. It's brief. For the most part, Americans don't know that there was a time less than 100 years ago that there were no 40-hour work weeks, no OSHA, no workman's comp, no protections, no right to unionize. 1938 authorized all that and changed the labor landscape. At the time, under the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938, there was a little section called Section 14C, and you'll often hear 14C interchanged with subminimum wages. It's just the part of the law that allows for subminimum wages. It was initially designed for veterans and folks who were getting injuries on farms and in factories so that people could return to work. It was never intended really for folks with intellectual and developmental disabilities, other neurodivergent disabilities. And so it starts this kind of the impetus for what I call, and I give full credit to a wonderful thought thinker and a policymaker, or I'd also say a disruptor, Kathy Snow, who called it for the first time the disability industrial complex, after pointing that after the military industrial complex. Why would she say that? Well, it's really simple. There's billions of dollars in both of those industrial complexes. We don't know what gets done with the dollars in our name, right? In either the military industrial complex or the disability industrial complex. And outcomes are really few and far between. So it spurs on, this law spurs on abuses. Now, many people will often say this, well, I thought this was outlawed in the 80s, but I was shocked, I think, as someone, again, who has loved ones with disabilities, who's worked in this field, I was shocked at how many congressional oversight committees, hearings, sessions bringing this topic up in health and labor and in education, and that over and over in these congressional records, you don't hear anything positive. There's nothing positive about the approach. It's all about how the U.S. Department of Labor doesn't do any oversight, how there's abuse of paying people subminimum wages. And then I guess the most important part, I think, for listeners is to understand since Henry's Turkey Service. And just real briefly, that's where 30 plus men had been human trafficked, all with intellectual and developmental disabilities, from institutions in Texas to slaughtering houses, poultry slaughtering houses in South Carolina, and in this case, Iowa, a very small town, Adelissa, Iowa. And in 1979, there were front page exposés by a reporter at the Des Moines Register, and it's damning as well. 1979, it does not get closed down until 30 years later, 2009. The men were made fun of, physically abused, sexually abused. Some of the men ran away from the turkey slaughtering farm. One person died in the cold. Some of the folks they would bring back if they ran away and chained to beds. And so there's a shameful history of this. And just one other thing real briefly. Prior to all this, we have abuses across the country. In 1974, two men in Indiana institutions sued the state of Indiana and Governor Bayh based on subminimum wages paid in institutions. They found that these folks were living in institutions where we as a culture say there's something wrong with you, so you need to go to a mental health institution. Yet these folks were working full-time jobs inside the institution. And they won that case. And one of the things that was amazing about it, it was that they didn't lose, they won it on labor law, but they also won it on the prohibition of slavery. The first judge found that, yes, this was very similar to indentured servitude. It was overturned by the Indiana Supreme Court, and nothing ever happened in 1974. My point here is that year after year, decade after decade, right up until now in 2023, we are struggling with this arcane policy that people turn into a binary situation. In other words, folks will say, well, what are these workers going to do if they don't have a sheltered workshop to go to? We've proven over and over and over again, people can work in the community with the right supports. So changing the narrative here is probably the most important. But the disability industrial complex has spent millions lobbying against getting rid of subminimum wages. That's a shock, I think, for most Americans.
So the term disability industrial complex seems to very much follow the profit logic. Yes. Could you elaborate this a little bit? Who are actually representing the interests and representing the forces against the legislation?
Yes. It's, you know, it's interesting. What happens? There's a what we call a narrative arc in this story, right? And so if you look at the passage in 1938 and you go through the 40s and 50s, there's not much happening there. But once we get into the early 60s, from then on, we have about 60 years of this congressional testimony about how it isn't working. Amongst all of that, in 1986, something happens that actually really kind of is the impetus for creating the modern disability industrial complex. What happens is states where there are a lot of sheltered workshops and subminimum wages going on start to form trade organizations, and they start looking around, right, both in the state legislative houses and Congress, and they start patterning their lobbying after energy companies, fossil fuel companies, the gun manufacturers, pharmaceuticals, insurance, and they go, the way you win this and keep change from happening is spending money. And in 1986, prior to 1986, there was kind of an agreement that any worker with a disability in the United States, regardless of where they lived, wouldn't be paid less than half of the current minimum wage. Now, in 1986, you know, that's less, if half is less than $2 an hour, but that was kind of the view. But these trade groups get together and they lobby Congress and they say, get rid of, and this is the most absurd phrase in the entire book, the minimum subminimum wage. In other words, take that floor out. They lobbied successfully to do that. And then we start seeing these paychecks for a penny an hour, 22 cents an hour. We start seeing people spending 40, 50 hours a week in a sheltered workshop doing these tasks and bringing home a check of $2 or $3. And so they figured out lobbying in 1986. And from then on, we have this modern disability industrial complex, to your point, that views disability as physically productive, right? They still view all of that in a capitalistic way, that the way that it maybe an industrial organizational psychologist might view work. And so folks with disabilities don't get services and supports on the things they're good at. They end up being units of minds and bodies that can be billed off of. Medicaid dollars, vocational rehabilitation dollars, state dollars. And so the modern disability industrial complex doesn't want anyone to leave those segregated programs, because that means they don't have any way to bill for saying somebody continues to need to be fixed. And so we are rooted, just to put a fine point on it, in the United States, not only in a capitalistic model of disability, but we also are deeply embedded in a medical model where people need to be fixed before they can do things. And so you combine those forces, capitalism, a strong focus on physical productivity, a medical model, and there's some other things. And then you throw lobbying on top of that. It shouldn't surprise us in what we get, which is particularly for workers in the United States with intellectual and developmental disabilities, upwards of 80% unemployment. And this story is important to remind listeners that a disability is varied. It's very diverse. My sister is different than the next person with the same label. But in a medical model, we treat labels and conditions rather than the person.
Right. We are talking to Doug Randell, who wrote the book, 22 Cents an Hour, Disability Rights and the Fight to End Subminimum Wages. So you mentioned sheltered workshop and all these combined identities or roles allocated to these workshops. And that's kind of crucial for them to treat workers with disabilities. So do you think it is to combine, to assign so many roles to sheltered workshop? Because that's kind of common, right? Everywhere we're seeing these sheltered workshop. And many ordinary people seem to have very positive views on these if they don't actually know much about the employment condition and the payment system.
It's a great question. It's also one of the surprises. It's not something I didn't know, but in the research, I didn't know in the congressional record there was such knowledge about these conflicting roles. So at the bare minimum, a sheltered workshop is supposed to be an employer, right? That's what they're supposed to be. But they also receive, in addition to profits off the backs of folks with disabilities, they can bill federal and state disability funding streams for things like pre-employment services, pre-vocational services, all this pre stuff, right? None of us without disabilities have to put up with that kind of system. We learn on the job or we don't. But in the disability industrial complex, these are folks who are never ready in their eyes, must always be fixed, and they continue to bill. So what has happened over the decades is they've moved from employer to a therapist to residential supports. In many cases, these sheltered workshops are Social Security payees for the person. So a person with a disability might be receiving SSI. They live in a group home, go to a sheltered workshop that's controlled by the same nonprofit that has a beautiful, wonderful mission statement that talks about inclusion and kindness and being part of the community. And then people are segregated, poor, congregated, have very bad outcomes. There's a moment in the story that happens after the wage floor in 1986. And it's a lawyer named Donald Ellisberg, really an iconic labor lawyer, civil rights lawyer, fascinating man. But for a time, he worked inside of the U.S. Department of Labor in a subunit called Wage and Hour, the Wage and Hour Division. And it's always been responsible for overseeing subminimum wage certificates that these sheltered workshops apply for and get authorization to pay subminimum wages. And Ellisberg thought the system could be fixed, but in 1994, he really testifies in these hearings in Congress over a couple things. One, after the 1986 amendments, it was put into law that if a sheltered workshop employee had a disagreement about how they were being paid, that sheltered workshop employee could appeal to the United States Department of Labor, the secretary. And Ellisberg goes, no one's going to be able to do that. That's ridiculous. That's just fake language. The other thing that it said is if you brought any kind of lawsuit as a sheltered workshop subminimum wage employee against the 14C holder, then you would have to pay for all those legal fees. So Ellisberg is saying this system in 1994 is so broken, it must be overturned now. And as you have heard earlier and through the book, 2/3 of the states in the country still allow subminimum wages. In fact, Illinois just had a very large legislative struggle and lost the ability to ban subminimum wages. So it's still legal there. And so we see this, you know, these conflicting roles just adding to it benefits the disability industrial complex, as you pointed out. If just the average American thinks, oh, they're helping people with disabilities. And my suggestion to people is, you know, certainly I'd love them to read the book, but if you don't do that, find out who has 14C certificates in your state, in your community. Ask for a tour. Ask why people aren't working in the community. All those kinds of questions, because as I say in the book, just like the military-industrial complex, all of this is being done in our name, and we're all responsible for that. And so we must be aware. There's a lot to attend to these days, socially and around civil rights, but we can't leave folks with disabilities in the United States behind, and we have to be able to advocate for those folks who are most significantly impacted. Being paid 22 cents an hour is the greatest way in an economic system like the United States to say you're worth absolutely nothing. Yeah. And I think that's a shame for future generations. I guess I'll just leave it at this. We have to pay attention. It is a labor movement issue. It's a civil rights issue. But these folks have never been able to unionize, never been able to advocate for themselves for fair pay. And that's all because of really bad public policy and law.
Right. And it's really a shame to the whole society that how we treat our most vulnerable fellows. Thank you, Doug.
Thank you very much.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight.
Good evening, and welcome to another edition of Know Your Rights. This is Mike Amash with the law firm of Blake & Ulig. This month on Know Your Rights, we are going to discuss the Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA. Specifically, we're going to cover Title I of the ADA, which deals with discrimination in employment practices. Under Title I of the ADA, employers, including state and local governments with 15 or more employees, are prohibited from discriminating against people with disabilities. Title I protects qualified individuals with disabilities in several areas, including the job application process and procedures, hiring, firing, advancement, compensation, and job training. It is also unlawful to retaliate against someone for opposing employment practices that discriminate based on disability or for filing an ADA discrimination charge. So under Title I, discrimination is prohibited against qualified individuals with disabilities. A person is disabled under the ADA if they have a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities, and that person has a record of such an impairment or is regarded as having such an impairment. It is important to note that the ADA does not include, nor do any regulations include, an exhaustive list of disabilities. But in order to obtain coverage under Title I of the ADA, the individual must show a mental or physical impairment that substantially limits a major life activity. So what's a major life activity? Think of things like seeing, hearing, speaking, walking, breathing, performing manual tasks, learning, caring for oneself, and of course, working. Disability examples might include vision or hearing impairment. What is not included as a disability under the ADA are minor, non-chronic conditions of short duration. Think of things such as a sprain or a broken limb. So who is a qualified individual with a disability under Title I of the ADA? It's a person who meets legitimate skill, experience, education, or other requirements of an employment position and can perform the essential functions of the position with or without reasonable accommodations. The term essential functions is an important one. An inability to perform marginal or incidental job functions does not make a person unqualified. An essential function is the fundamental job duties of a position. It may be considered essential because it's the reason the job exists, there are a limited number of employees available who can perform the job, or the job function is highly specialized, so that the person was hired for their skill or expertise in performing that function. So if we have a qualified individual who can perform the essential functions of a job, an employer must make a reasonable accommodation under the ADA. So they have an obligation to accommodate the disabled employee or applicant. Now, generally, a reasonable accommodation is any modification or adjustment to a job or the work environment that will enable an otherwise qualified applicant or employee with a disability to participate in the application process or perform an essential job function. Now, what's important in the term reasonable accommodation is reasonable. What is reasonable under Title I of the ADA? Employer is not required to make an accommodation if it would impose a, quote, undue hardship on the employer's business. An undue hardship is an action requiring significant difficulty or expense. Factors to consider might include the nature and cost of the accommodation, the overall financial resources of the facility and the employer, and the impact of the accommodation on the facility, including the impact of the ability of other employees to perform their job duties. Nonetheless, an employer is required under the ADA to go through this interactive process of determining whether a reasonable accommodation could be made for an individual with a disability. That's all the time we have this month on Know Your Rights. Thank you very much, and be well.
And we're out of time at the Heartland Labor Forum, so if you want the calendar, you're going to have to go to the Facebook page. That's facebook.com, Heartland Labor Forum. The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. I'm Stephen Hill in for Judy Ansel. Stay tuned for the Thursday night special. It's a replay of this morning's Cowtown Conversations, a conversation with League of Women Voters on the 20th June 2023 municipal election. Stay safe, everyone.
Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back to us too. Send us your feedback, your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to Heartland Labor Forum, KKFI@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming ones, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on this show are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening at 6 or to our rebroadcast Friday mornings at 5 right here, 90.1 FM, KKFI.